It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. We have a terrific author coming up here, Doug Melville, who's written a book called Invisible Generals, Rediscovering Family Legacy and a Quest to Honor America's First Black Generals. And David and I were just talking before we started. It's a terrific book. I feel a little bit like when we had Lena Andrews on talking about Valiant Women, where I felt like I kind of knew the women in World War II story, but I thought it was Rosie Riveter. It was so much more. I kind of thought I knew the blacks in World War II thing and Tuskegee, so much more. And Doug has captured it in a really wonderful book. As importantly, he's fascinating. So I think we're going to be spending a lot of time with Doug Melville. I mean, I'll just start and stop with Quincy Jones. Anybody who got to intern for Quincy Jones.
Yes.
I could do hours on that. But Lauren Larson is helping us out with the important work this evening. I love how Lauren gets us rolling and then she's gone. He's like out. Claude pretends to care for a couple of minutes and then he's out and comes back.
And like Claude, Lauren has very, very important things that she has to do that do not involve listening to our drivel.
Lauren just came back. That's so hilarious. Bye, Lauren. Go away. Christmas shopping and online shopping. Claude, I believe, is in Philadelphia this evening doing the Wizards.
Oh, is that right? To watch them get annihilated again? So
I don't think that's going to be a good night. And Jamie McIntyre is with us, of course, who sadly will not be celebrating the holidays in Georgetown, which I thought he and Roberta were going to be. Maybe
not
next time.
Not a final decision yet. We still have time.
Okay. Like I said, if I were in town, I would dress up like an elf and park your car for you. But I think I'll be gone.
That alone would have made it worth it. That would have been the deciding factor.
Somewhere, how quickly can we digress? Somewhere, Jamie, don't you have on one of the original camera phones video of me dressed up as a bunny rabbit on Easter?
Ooh,
Easter egg hunt, because I think you threatened me at the time. It had to have been the early 2000s Easter egg hunt at our house.
I will find that. If I have it, I'll find it. Because if I took it, and I remember the event, but if I have the video, I'll find it.
I will pay cash money, sir. Cash.
Yes.
Hold our cash.
I'll send you pictures, David. For at least 25 years, Brian and I have donned bunny outfits for Easter. And we used to have this, you've been to our place, we used to have this big yard, and we used to have a spectacular Easter egg hunt for all the neighborhood kids. Mm-hmm. And the first year, we started out with a measly 200 or 300 plastic eggs filled with stuff. Uh-huh. I quickly realized that was not enough. And so subsequent years, it was literally 3,000 or 4,000 plastic eggs filled with candy and coins and stuff like that.
God. And did you find more eggs in the yard for like months or even years?
No, those little monsters, are you kidding? They hoovered up every single egg within 1,000 miles. No, awful. Awful. Oh, and kids would steal from one another, like some poor little child would find 6 or 7 eggs and be ecstatic and just maybe turn his back for a second. And the other ones would swoop in and steal them from his basket. As the kids got older, it reached a Lord of the Flies kind of situation.
Okay. Well, I remember my nephews, we had an Easter egg hunt and he figured out that the eggs had money in them. We told him they could only have so many eggs. You couldn't, you know, and so he would pick up the egg and shake it. If he could hear money in it, he'd keep it. And if it didn't hear money in it, he figured it was candy and he put it back. So he was only going after the money.
Nice
so
try.
When the kids got together to open up their eggs, I slipped a $100 bill into my daughter's egg. So when she opened it, it didn't make any noise, but then I had a $100 bill in it, which I then made her give back to me later.
Yeah, exactly. That's a loan. That's
just, but his face just fell when that.
But you taught him an important life lesson.
Yeah, I don't know. I did. Maybe.
I can't believe you did.
Which is you're never too old to play tricks on kids.
Yeah.
I think that's a life lesson.
I would go get like a plastic finger and I'd put it in one of the eggs and a toe and something and just really freak the kids out. That's what I would do.
That's spectacular. You know, when they become teens and tweens and teens, you can pull that stuff. That'd be great. Okay, we have lots to cover, and we're going to get out at 50 minutes in for those of you who are listening in the evening hours, because it's the holidays and people need to get onto their holiday celebrating. Something I never do often enough. Thank you for those of you who send in emails. I try to respond to all of them. I don't always, but thank you. Really, really appreciate it. And we've got a couple here that could be for anybody, but I'm going to make them for both of you, maybe all of us. And I don't know if anybody wants their names used, so I'm not going to use names. I'm just going to use R. And says, Tori, you always ask the authors in 60 seconds more. Paren, David, I like, and paren. What's the one book you take to deserted island if you're going there by all by yourself for the rest of your life? Well, what about you all? And maybe we've done this, but maybe we haven't. So David, Jamie, alphabetically, David, then Jamie, then Tori. David, deserted island, all by yourself, only one book for the rest of your life.
Forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever.
Oh, yeah. And just think, you're going to be holding it. It's a real book. It's hardcover. And those pages, they're going to get worn.
I know. I know. God, that's hard. This is tough.
So isn't it?
I'm going to
no,
be
stop.
Really...
It's not your turn yet. It's not your turn yet.
No. You know, I say To Kill a Mockingbird with everything, but I know that's probably not what I should do.
But isn't it interesting that you say that?
Yeah, it is interesting, but I think it's also kind of telling. Of where I grew up in.
Yeah.
Get back to me. Come back. I'll get back in the
okay,
queue.
Go ahead, Jamie.
This is going to sound really nerdy, but you know, I'm really thinking about this practically, that you're going to be stuck with this book for the rest of your life on a deserted island. And a couple of years ago, I mentioned this book and I think people laughed at me, but I have this book on my shelf called The Great American Bathroom Book. And it's simply a condensation of about, I don't know, 300 great novels, poetry. It's all in one thing. It's the idea is it's designed for each thing to be just short enough you could read it on the throne in the bathroom. And I would probably pick some sort of anthology like that. Or maybe they don't even sell these anymore, I don't think. But the I always used to enjoy getting the World Almanac every year and reading all the facts and figures and history that's in that one little World Almanac book, which they used to publish a new one every year.
Which year would you pick? Because you can only take one year.
Well, I would take the latest year that was available because it goes, you know, the history goes backwards, not forward. So it doesn't tell you what's going to happen. So those would probably be my picks. I'm trying to remember, there was some famous author, and I couldn't remember who it was, who was asked this question on the BBC show Desert Island Discs, where they asked this question about what records, what one book.
Oh, sure. What one song?
What object you would take. And the person, I can't remember which author it was, said they would take their own autobiography. And the object that they would take was a mirror.
Ooh.
I know.
Ooh.
I know.
Okay, there are many problems with that. Including just, you know, watching yourself age on this desert island by yourself. Okay. Remember we had Victoria Murray on. Victoria Murray, and oh, I feel terrible. I can't remember the co-author. They wrote the great book about Eleanor Roosevelt and Mary Bethune. Victoria Murray said, which I thought was very smart, she goes, the best survival guide book out there. That's what I want. Yeah. So I think I would want that because I kind of know how to, you know, I don't know how to tie knots. I know how to start a fire. That's about it. But I would want a survival guide, I think. And then if I can take some fiction, I want to take Don Quixote because I think it's just that it's about optimism. It's about perseverance. It's about there's something on the other side. So I would like those two. Okay.
Well, the Boy Scout handbook might qualify for that.
What's it called?
The Boy Scout handbook. I was a Boy Scout and they gave us a handbook. It had all kinds of useful information in it.
Yeah.
First aid, how to build
no,
a fire,
I want, I want
how to
one
make
of those,
shelter.
No, I want one of those awesome former special ops guys, Jamie.
Okay.
And we've had a couple of them on, but now we've lost David. Okay, so pressure's on, McIntyre.
Uh-oh, okay.
All right, you ready for the second one? And this email, we've gotten versions of this from several people. They want recommendations for gifts of books. And specifically, if you could recommend one book or two books, it's okay, of Chatter on Books authors. / books that we've had on. David's back.
Well, thank God he's back because he punted on the last question. And
no,
I
okay. All the President's Men. That's why I decided. All the President's Men. I love that book.
I liked To Kill a Mockingbird better.
You liked that better? Okay, To Kill a Mockingbird.
There we go. Okay, done. Okay, here's the next one, David. So several people have written in with versions of this asking for recommendations. You know, I've got a cousin who likes this. Can you recommend a book? Those kinds of things. And I try and I epically fail. But most of them say, okay, if you were just going to recommend one book gift this year and it's somebody who's appeared on Chatter on Books, what author, what book would you recommend?
Wow.
That's hard. That's like, who's your favorite child?
Right? Oh my God. I would need a list of show here to be able to,
It's you.
because we've got some really great authors on.
We've had some really great authors, and people ask me this, and they'll ask me sometimes just I see them somewhere else, and I go, wait a minute. And I start scrolling through, I go to
Right?
chatterbox.com, and I start scrolling through, go, oh my God, here's a great one. Well, if you like this, here's a great one.
Exactly.
Just in the last few weeks, I've given easily 10 or 15 copies of The Purest Bond, the canine book, the human canine
Yes,
connection,
yes.
to many people. I've given The Sunset Crowd to many, many high school friends. We were all into the 70s, and we wish we lived in LA in the
Right.
70s.
Yeah.
Because that's where the real sex, drugs, and rock and roll was. It was not in Pittsburgh, shockingly. Then things that just keep popping into, Olga Dies Dreaming, so Chio Gonzalez, things just keep popping up into my mind, but I have to really scroll through and then look at the person who's asking me and give them a good
Right,
recommendation.
right,
Well, I'm
right.
going with your picks, and if you have me on again, I'll have more time to think about it, and I'll come up with my own
Hold
picks.
on. I'm looking through all of our years. Manny Jennings wrote a great book, by the way, for
Oh,
example.
spectacular. I've given
Yeah.
away, I know I've given, I have literally 20 copies of that book.
Yeah. So I mean, the Bissinger book was really good. The Mosquito Girl was really
Oh, that was
good. Remember, that was right
spectacular.
at the beginning of the year.
Yes. Yeah, Buzz Bissinger, that was terrific.
But you know what? It doesn't matter the age or the genre of the reader. Like if it's okay for them to read a book about kind of adult stuff, Ed Amar's book was great. No Time for Killers. That was fantastic. I really
Really
liked it.
good
But
one.
this is a trick question because, no matter how great the book is, if that's the one you have to read over and over and over again, it has to be something you can read over and over and over again.
I'll tell you what,
Or you
Jay.
can just stop reading
No, swear to
when you're on
God,
the desert island.
and I do think this show's got a little bit of a, we got a bit of a rep and a bit of a vibe, and the authors are often as interesting and informative as the books themselves.
Yes.
But to your point, Jamie, any one of those books that we've had on, I could, and sometimes I have gone back and read them again. I don't know if I want to take each one of them to my desert island the rest of my life, but I have liked so many of them, and I feel the way, David on Tony's show, how he talks about the music, they have the people who send the music. There's so much talent out there.
Yes,
I'm
yes.
just stunned at the talent out there.
It is amazing, and it's heartening to me that there's so many great authors out there
Yeah.
writing really
Well,
great books.
my favorite author, and the one I actually read books over and over again every couple, 5, 10 years, read the same book over and over again, are the John D. MacDonald series about Travis McGee, which I started reading when I was a student in Florida and just fell in love with them. And the writing is so good. It's the some of the events have sort of not aged that well, but I can read those over and over again. All I need is enough time to forget what happened in the book, and I can read it again.
With me, that's yesterday.
Yes.
That is, Dave, do you know about concussion protocols and concussions and repetitive head injuries and all these kind of things?
Yes.
I've been bounced on my head a few times, I'm happy to admit. Sometimes diagnosed with a concussion, sometimes not. But the short-term memory thing is a real deal, right?
Yeah, that happens. You've
Thank
had too
you.
many of them. Stuff starts to go.
Well, it's the short-term stuff. It's as in, oh yeah, I need to look that up. And by the time I get to where it's gone. Okay. All right, 6:17. We got a cruise.
Well, did you want to do the? You mentioned something. Did you want to talk about Patrick Mahomes? Is that something you wanted to talk
Yes.
about? Okay.
Okay. So Patrick Mahomes, you need to give us the CNN headlines version of what happened this weekend and why he had such an outburst. And then I have a comment and a question about
Okay. Well, very quickly, they were in a very close game with Buffalo,
it.
and he threw a pass to Travis Kelce, the great tight end, who ran about 10 yards down the field and turned around and threw a lateral across the field to a teammate. It was not, I don't think, a designed play. I think he just saw someone in red and said,
Something.
"He's open."
It was a great improvisation.
And the guy caught the ball and ran into the end zone for what looked to be the game-winning touchdown, except there was a penalty flag on the field. And the guy who caught the ball, the lateral, and ran in for the touchdown had lined up offsides. And called offsides on him, and that negated the play. And the Chiefs went nuts because it's a very kind of ticky-tack call. But he was offsides. He was offsides. Like, I don't know what to tell you. It was a penalty. They called it. Like, wasn't the greatest call, but it was an illegal play, and they called it. He was clearly offsides, and they called it. So it happens.
And Patrick went nuts.
He went nuts because sometimes this doesn't happen every time because the referees are under no obligation to do this. Sometimes if a player, you'll notice a wide receiver will line up and then he will turn to his left or right. He's turning to an official and he does this. And what he's saying is, am I good?
Yeah.
That's his way of saying, is this legal where I'm standing right now?
Right.
And sometimes the referee will go, yes, it's legal. Or he'll go, no, it's not legal. And he'll have a chance to correct himself. But that doesn't happen every time. And they are not obligated to do that, by the way. They don't have to say anything. Because that happened to the Commanders last year in a game in a very similar situation.
Yep.
Their receivers, he lined up. He went to the official. The official didn't say anything. So he thought I was good. And as soon as the play ball was snapped, they threw the flag and negated a big play. So it happens.
Okay. Here's what so again, it happened. The number of times I've heard you talk about this, Dave, well, you know, the ref called, it was a foul. The ref called it. And there's this sub debate about, well, in a certain game, at a certain point of game, should they call it? It's the end of the season. Should they call it? It's a rule. They should probably call it. So there's that. But I hate social media, but kind of following this in social media, how could Pat, you know, that he was out of control. He was this, he, you know, that's not his job. These kinds of things. They were criticizing him for his emotion about it.
Oh, well, that's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. Yeah, and I liked it. I like it in the age and stage in which every executive in a business, every athlete at every level is expected to maintain, you know, a perfect, rigid, whatever, persona at all times and never exhibit any honest feelings, any emotions, anything like that. In sports of all places, it's insane to expect that, but they do. And the kind of judgments people were casting on Patrick Mahomes for that, I thought was insane. Because I think he's been terrific for the game, terrific for the sport.
Absolutely.
But that was insane.
He did lose his cool, and
Jamie, it's okay. Lost his cool in a context, in a place, and in a context where it was okay.
Right, except you know he was he did yell at the refs that this was, you know, how could you offensive offsides? How could you call that? This is the worst effing call, I've never seen it in my entire lifetime. And he's throwing his helmet and he's going crazy. And you know, you sometimes see that kind of really just emotional response when they call a play at the very end of the game that changes the outcome of the game. But usually it's some sort of pass interference call or something where you can actually see that the play is going to be a big play. They called this offside before the play really even unfolded.
That's true.
Because Tony had his foot half a foot over the line.
Clearly offside.
And you know, the referee said, things like, you know, if they ask us for guidance, we try to give them guidance. But as David said, they're not obligated to do that. When they don't look at us and when their foot is actually placed where we can't see the ball anymore because it's blocking the ball. I get the emotion. There were some very good lip reading videos that circulated afterwards that showed. But he wasn't penalized. He wasn't thrown out of the game. I mean, he wasn't
Jamie McIntyre has sat next to my husband at a hockey game, and my husband's emotions used to be expressed primarily in the playoffs, but now it's just any game.
And his random game against Columbus, he'll just go
any random game, and the things he says to and about refs. But we're going to skip our thing about
folks that are being
made into movies. And our author Doug Melville is I think still going to join us if he hasn't gotten.
I would be long gone if I were Doug, but that's me. That's
We should track the timing of this because when the authors check in, we always ask them to check in about 20, you know, link in about 20 after.
Yes.
They must go, what the flip show am I on?
Exactly.
Doug Melville, are you still there?
I know. We see that he's still in, but he may be like I would be answering my email right now.
Calling Doug Melville. Calling. Are you there?
I certainly wouldn't be here anymore.
I think it'd be great if one of them eventually just abandons us and says,
no, I was just real quick.
I'm here.
Doug is listening and deciding whether or not he wants to stay.
How are you?
It's my break. I don't know if I stay or go.
To put that slide up that they used to have on TV that said, please stand by. Our, you know, our crack technical team is working on it. And they had a, we have a cartoon with a guy holding a plug unplugged. You remember those? Please stand by.
Doug Melville,
no adjustment
welcome
to your set is necessary.
Welcome to Chatter on Books, and thank you for joining us. It's great to have you.
Thank you for allowing the chatter to be about my title. So thank you. I appreciate that.
It is so much about the title, the book, and Doug, David and I, and Jamie and I were talking before we started rolling here tonight. The book is fantastic, Invisible Generals, and it's fantastic and wonderful, and we've all learned something, we're smarter than they were, etc. But, you know, we usually spend the first X minutes of this segment kind of doing the backstory of the authors and like, the, you know, what they wanted to be when they were five and these kinds of things, which is all great. Never, ever, ever. We've had people who were lawyers, people who were astronauts, people who were, you know, wanted to be all sorts of things. Never, ever, ever have we had anybody on who, among other things, interned for Quincy Jones. And yeah. I could just start and stop my life on that right there. It's like, I'm done. That's good. Yeah. Hangs out with Tommy Hilfiger. And yeah. then the Wienermobile?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Come you know, on. Who else can tell you they saw all 48 continental United States in the Wienermobile?
Okay, we'll get to the really serious important stuff, Doug, but let's just start there and work backwards. What years? Because I probably saw you.
It could have been. It was 98 to 99. The campaign for the year was called Share the Smiles. Uh-huh. And, you know, just to tell a little bit about the Wienermobile, just because you may never, you know, normally talk to someone who lived in it for a year. But they only let you do the job out of college, first job. They train you for 30 days in something called Hot Dog High.
Okay, where you stop. Go to I'm Madison, sorry. Repeat that, because sometimes the sound isn't perfect on this show. They train you for 30 days in something called what?
Hot Dog High. So what you do is they the Wienermobile, there's six Wienermobiles. And at the time I did it, there was three people on each hot dog. Now there's two. But
job cuts. You hate that.
Job cuts, you know, we cut. But the third person was key because you're in the road for 1 year in a row with this person. So you go for 30 days of training in the hot dog high. They teach you how to fix the car. They teach you all the puns. They teach you how to do an interview. They teach you how to, you know, do a promotion, you know, how to film the commercials. And essentially you're paid to be the PR machine of Oscar Mayer. Uh-huh. And then you crisscross the country
very
and you
slowly.
Do that for 365 days. And that's the 400-day job.
Yeah. Well, I'm guessing that's a job that you did with some relish.
Oh! Yeah. It was wonderful. Oh! It was wonderful.
I had to do that for David. He was talking about puns earlier.
Yeah. They give you a whole list of puns, the pun, the bun roof, you know, that cuts the mustard, can't wait to catch up. You know, they have a whole ecosystem of the puns. So I'm glad, you know, I'm glad we talk about it. I never really talk about the Wienermobile. But I'm glad to
Are
share.
You kidding?
I'm glad to share about it.
That is the best. Okay, last thing on the Wienermobile. What was the greatest life lesson you learned as a Wienermobile ambassador? Wasn't that the title? Weren't you an ambassador?
Yeah. Wienermobile ambassador. I think my greatest learning of that was how amazing the world is if you get out of your office. You know, I mean, we're stuck in these offices. They keep making the computers better, but you know, if people actually went to the places.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you could, you know, I don't have to tell you all, you travel a lot, but sometimes when you travel too much, you don't appreciate it because it's boring and tiring and blah, blah, right. blah. But I think my biggest learning, because it was my first job out of school, was never settle for a desk job.
Good for you. That's fabulous. Okay. How does one make a leap? Because I might try to replicate this in my next life when I come back from the Wienermobile, which again, a lot of people could live and die on that and go, that was spectacular, to interning for Quincy Jones.
Well, yeah, actually the internship was before the Wienermobile, but it was an intern for him. I think I was his last intern at the record label, Quest Records. He still had the production company. Uh-huh. It was the last year of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and In the House with LL Cool J, Vibe TV, if you remember that show that was on briefly. Yeah. And then he also was producing Mad TV, if you remember that. Oh, yeah. And then the Jenny Jones show, he was producing that too. So I got to be an intern and kind of see the music side of it and then also the TV side of it. And, you know, he was more like a Yoda figure to me because I was so low on the food chain. But he really was helpful to me. And he would always say, Douglas, you work harder than people I pay. You know, because, you know, in college, when you're doing that free internship.
Sure.
You know, Dave, it's, you know, either you're good at it or it's right. not good. But something's got to give.
What's your greatest life lesson from him?
He used to give me this piece of advice. Your reputation is the only thing that precedes you when you walk into a room. Mm-hmm. Spend it wisely. Mm-hmm. So he would always say, you know, 85% of every decision that directly affects your life, you're not in the room to have a say, but your reputation speaks for you. Mm-hmm. So he would always make sure everything I did was based on your reputation. He would say, when you get a mortgage approval, you're not in the room. When you want to get a job, you're not in the room. When, you know, the only thing that's moving you is this reputation. So his big life lesson for me was importance of reputation management.
Wow.
Wow, that's profound. That's
we can really just forget the book.
We could go all the way through after the Wienermobile.
It was great.
we could go down the line. It's been a good journey.
We have got to spend time on this book, Invisible Generals, Rediscovering Family Legacy and a Quest to Honor America's First Black Generals. Because, Doug, a few weeks ago, we had on this wonderful woman, Lena Andrews, a military analyst for the CIA and very cool person. She wrote a book called Valiant Women, which is about the women in World War II. And I think we all came away from that going, okay, we thought we kind of knew the women in World War II story and Rosie the Riveter, and there was so much more. And I kept reading this and page after page after page, and I listened to it as well. And good for you for doing the audio version, because that's really hard. And I kept thinking, wow, I didn't know. It's not that I didn't know the half of it. I didn't know 2/3 of it. But this started out as kind of a personal journey for you, correct?
Yeah, this started out as one of those things where you kind of like scratch an itch and then realize there's a whole nother reality behind it. Yeah. I knew growing up that Ben Davis Jr., who's the main character in the book. So The Invisible Generals is the story of America's first two black generals, and they were a father and a son. So the father in the story, I never met. He died in 1970, so it was before I was born. But the son in the story was the man who raised my father from the time he was 7. And he was the most integral part of my whole family. So every holiday, he paid for my college, bought me my car, my first set of golf clubs, real woods, by the way. And I was like, what are these clubs? He's like, Doug, these are woods. I'm like, my friend's woods aren't wood. This is how I knew who he was. But when we went to his home, it was all feng shui. He had lived many years in Asia. I didn't know that at the time, but my parents always say, you know, he always wants peace. You know, he never had any pictures of the war or anything, on the wall that would discern what he had done. But we would always go to Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, and everybody would salute him and everybody would run up to him. And I would always say, hey guys, what does Ben do? And they would be like, oh, Doug, you know, he fought and so you could be free. He did things so you don't have to worry about it. So we don't really want you to worry about it. There's really nothing to see. And that was just kind of the way it was. And then in 1998, we all got invited to the White House. And after 10 years of lobbying by Senator John McCain, President Bill Clinton invited our family to the White House to elevate Ben Jr. to 4-star general. And I knew that that was big, but still really didn't know because I was, you know, right out of college. I was actually driving the Wienermobile at the time.
Did you pull it up right in front of the White House? Because that would have been really cool.
I did pull it up in front of the White House. The road used to be open there. It's now closed. I like these level of questions, Victoria. I did pull it up to the White House. But I have a story in the book that the Oscar Mayer had given me a Wienermobile to give to the president, but it was in the middle of the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Bad timing.
Doesn't work on so many levels.
I just couldn't do it, Jamie. I said, I cannot hand this president this Wienermobile.
Oh, Lord.
At this ceremony that I'm at for the 4th star.
Right.
The night before he got the fourth star, there was a huge argument in the home, and the family was really upset because in order for him to get the fourth star, we had to sign a piece of paper that our family would not get financially compensated for the 31 years that had passed backwards, where he was supposed to get the star in 1967 under LBJ. This is what I had learned later, but at the time, wow, I didn't know that. But he was supposed to get the star in 1967, but LBJ said he had done enough for civil rights. He had appointed Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court. He had passed Martin Luther King's civil rights agenda. So there was no political gain for him to promote a black to be a four-star general. Although at the time, he was well overqualified as a commander, yeah, of a numbered Air Force and all the other things he had done, but they forced him to retire. Now, I didn't know that until later, but the reason that was so important in this story is because we had to sign this piece of paper that said we wouldn't get the 31 years money for back pay, nor could he accrue future pay. And it was over $1 million. And his wife of over 60 years was so furious, she refused to go. And it caused a whole thing in the house. Mm. She told him not to go get the fourth star because if they were going to give the honor, which he had earned in name, then the honor should be accompanied with the money that went along with it if we would have gotten it at the time.
Right. Yeah.
And that was when I started realizing something was going on with this man that no one was really telling me. But there was a lot of energy. So we go to the White House the next day. His wife, Agatha, does not attend the ceremony. The seat was empty. It ended up getting filled. And the fourth star is pinned on him. And then he would die 4 years later. And something just didn't sit right about that moment with me. But, you know, you're young, out of school. You don't really get into it too much. You're trying to get your career started. Mm-hmm. You don't really have the ends or the means to. And there was really no internet because you're talking about 98. Sure. But he dies on the 4th of July, 2002. And no elected officials. Well, I'm not going to say none, but, you know, maybe one or two. No presidents, no congressmen, senators. They all sent these declaration letters. Hmm. You know, like, I wish I could be there. It's an honor. And I thought that was very weird, too. Like, something just didn't sit right. Like, how could none of these people go? It's in Arlington. You know, he passed away on the 4th of July. Like, I didn't really understand it. And that was kind of the end of it. And then in 2012, the movie Red Tails came out.
Yeah.
And in 2011, I was invited to a screening. And it was a private screening with the Tuskegee Airmen and with the actors. And Ben Davis Jr., who was played by Terrence Howard, and it was the reason why I was invited, was to be the main character in the movie. Mm-hmm. And when he shows up on screen, he looks like him, he talks like him, everything's perfect. But then they address him as Colonel Bullard, and they take out his real name as well as all the other Tuskegee Airmen's names from the movie. And again, I'm looking around going, what is going on here? Because people are a little upset, but I'm more upset.
Yeah.
And I'm asking the Tuskegee Airmen, and they're like, well, we thought our names were going to be in it, but I guess they're not in it. And I just sparked something, and I went home and I talked to my dad about it. And my dad goes, Doug, if you think changing names in a movie is bad, let me tell you the story about Ben and his father who raised me. We had to live as if we were invisible in order to survive. No one talked to us. And in the family, they were known as the invisible generals. And he tells me this story, Victoria. And I'm sitting here going, I just couldn't believe it was real. Yeah. And it started my quest to kind of say, okay, let me do a search here. Let me set a Google alert. Let me do basic, you know, kind of 101 things that I can control. And, that started on my journey to learn more about my own family story and uncovered what I share in the book.
So what was the explanation? Did you get an explanation for why they changed the name of this historic?
From Oprah Winfrey. Of all people.
It was a big meeting with Oprah Winfrey. Mm-hmm. And they had set up a private meeting for her and I to have a conversation. And there was other people there too. Tyler Perry was there, and you know, Gail. There was other, I mean, there was many people there beyond them, but in particular, they were the ones that were so excited that the movie was being made. And when they pulled me in the room, and Oprah was like, you know, Doug, what did you think of the movie? Can you believe it? We got the story made. And I had never met her, and she's peak Oprah in 98. So this is like running into Bigfoot, you know, like you're seeing someone that in real life you will never run into. Like, this is unbelievable. And all I'm thinking about is, wait, who was she the one responsible for changing the names? Does she know who it was? So I said, you changed the names. And she's like, Douglas, isn't this a great movie? And I was like, you know, you changed the names. She's like, no, Douglas, I didn't change the names. This is Hollywood. These are amalgamations of multiple people. This is not a documentary. We're not going to use all the real names in a movie. It's a story. And I just couldn't believe that most of the men who were there were in their 80s and 90s, oxygen machines. Some had nurses, you know, that these men were all invited to a movie about them in their prime. When they didn't fight for the money, they fought for their names. And for those names to be removed, to me, was a bridge too far.
Well, okay. I can see that because I remember
Jamie, hang on 1 second. I want to just lay on that top of that story, because it's so important in terms of the context and Doug tackling this story, is that here's this premiere, and Doug's like cool, hip. I mean, he's coming off the effing Wienermobile, for God's sake. And he's hanging with the Hollywood crowd. He thinks these are his people.
Yeah.
And then this starts to dawn on him, and Oprah delivers the news. Then he's with the folks in the 80s and 90s in the wheelchairs with the oxygen tanks going, wait a minute, there is something bigger, more important going on here. And there was a seismic shift in your approach to the whole story, right?
Yeah, I immediately stopped my career. So at the time I was, I had my own company called redcarpets.com, which is still around today, but we create and design the red carpet entrances for award shows and releases and things like that. So my life leading up to that for the 3 years prior was just going to different red carpets, taking pictures, setting them up, delivering them. Like, it was so frilly and privileged. So when the screening happened, I really felt like I was with Neo and Cuba Gooding and Terrence Howard. Like, I felt like they were my people. But then when this moment happened, then I said, wait, and maybe I'm with the other guys.
Yeah.
You know, so, Corey, I was just going to be a smart ass and say, oh, I get the Hollywood explanation, because I remember in the classic, you know, movie about D-Day in World War II, The Longest Day, that the commanding general was Dwight D. Jones, I think.
Right. Yeah, right.
You know, he was an amalgam, so we couldn't actually name him. But okay. I'm curious about, and I ask you this because I'm researching my own family history, which I won't go into, but this set you on this path to go fill in all these blanks that were in your family history. And what were the big things you discovered that you didn't know?
I think my overall takeaway is that the story that you were sharing earlier about the author who wrote the World War II book about women in the military.
Yeah.
And for the three of you, but for all your listeners, is history is almost been gerrymandered. It's all out there, but there's a drop here, a piece here, and someone has to go and pick it up and put it together. And in this case, it was me, but My biggest learning of this whole experience was, number one, is all the information is there. It's just separate and kind of gerrymandered. Number two is many of the families who are in these Hollywood movies are not paid, because people who work for the military, their stories are automatically public domain. So therefore, any journalist that interviews the family owns the rights versus the family. And when I started talking to people from different movies and seeing, you know, Martin Luther King's family didn't get paid for Selma, or Henrietta Lacks' family didn't get paid, or the Hidden Figures families, their compensation or devotion, the family didn't get paid, you know. Then I start realizing, okay, that was another huge learning. And then the information that I was finding was, number one, that they were the first two Black generals in American history, which was something my dad had told me, but, you know, I had to really make sure that was right. I think the surprising thing that had me turned on instead of turn the process off was at the start of World War II, out of the 335,000 people in the military, there was only two Black officers, and it was these two men, the father and a son. So when I thought of that, I said, 335,000 people in the military and only two Black men could give commands, but the military was still segregated. Then that got me into the story about West Point and Ben Davis Jr., the son, going there for 4 years with nobody speaking to him.
Yeah. I want to come back to that, and I want you to talk about that, because one of the things you do in this book, which is so fabulous, is, you know, sometimes when people are doing an historical account of something, they don't include the personal side of it. What was it really like to be in this person's shoes? And you do. And again, I have this kind of intellectual thought of, God, what must have been like to be Blacks, you know, in the military in those days. It never occurred to me how incredibly difficult it was to be at West Point. So I want you to talk about Ben Jr. at West Point, his 4 years there. And then we got to give David time, because we're going to get everybody out of here in a few minutes. But talk about him at West Point for 4 years and what he endured, because that did set him up for success in years and decades later. But talk about his time at West Point, when it was, what he had to endure.
So I think when I learned about Ben's time at West Point, this is what made me really get upset that the names were removed. Because I saw, you know, when you read what someone really went through, you're like, well, this story's equally as good as what you're hearing, probably better.
Right.
Yeah.
But what I found was Ben Jr., before he went to West Point, I tried to understand, how was he the only Black in West Point? Like, how did he even get to the situation where that was an opportunity for him?
Yeah.
And then I went back really quickly to his grandfather. So Ben Jr.'s grandfather was a babysitter for Ulysses S. Grant's son.
Mind blowing.
So they were tied in with DC in order to get the signatures, benefit of the doubts, be in rooms where Blacks were not allowed. So his dad tried to get into West Point. Ben Sr. was rejected by President McKinley because they didn't want to get in the habits of allowing Blacks in. His dad goes to Wyoming on a one-way train ticket, meets the only other Black graduate of West Point. His name was Charles Young. And Charles Young says, you could get into West Point and pass it if you trained your son, or someone trained anyone, from the time they were children. Kind of like you look at Venus and Serena or Tiger Woods or, you know, Shador Sanders. Like, if you train your child from the time they're born. So his dad, Ben Sr., has three children, wife dies in childbirth, single dad, and as a single dad, brings his son barnstorming to ease his stress because his mother's gone. And his son says, Daddy, I want to be a pilot. Now, instead of his dad saying, let's go get ice cream, his dad says, I can do that for you, but we have to go through West Point, because even the military can't turn down a West Point grad in the top third of their class. So you have to get the one Black signature. There's only one Black representative in the whole United States that could sign him in, because the signatures were segregated for who to get in. Ben Sr. has to sell the family house, relocate as a single dad, by the way, relocate to Illinois to live in the district to get the signature to get his son into West Point. Then his son arrives and they don't realize he's Black. They put him in a special room, which was a janitor's closet that had been reconfigured to be a single person's bedroom. And Ben goes to bed that night scared. You know, he's 19 years old. He doesn't understand what's going on. He doesn't really know. I mean, his dad told him. And the next morning, there's a meeting in the sinks where everybody meets. And in the meeting, he thinks that he's not invited because he's in a converted room and no one knocked. but the meeting was about him. And they said, from this moment on, we accidentally let an N-word into the academy. You were to treat him as if he's invisible until he drops out. He calls his dad shaking, and his dad goes, there's 13 million blacks rooting for you. He said, it's a shame none of them are here. And he goes, you're going to write that date on the board of when you graduate. And no matter what anybody does to you, you have to graduate. And he goes to that school for 4 years, 50 weeks a year, not one human interaction. Can't go in the library because it's segregated. Can't eat sitting down because the cadets have to approve you to sit because it's just a process.
Right.
He fails classes like boxing because there's no partner. And he studies and still graduates in the top third of his class, which should have allowed him to be a pilot. But because blacks were not legally allowed to operate heavy machinery, they tell him he was never going to be able to fly. So him and his dad at the graduation in 1936 are the only two black officers. They travel around for 4 years to black colleges teaching Army College because they're not allowed to be in charge of whites. And then FDR wants to get reelected. He wants to win the black vote. Blacks are voting Republican for Abraham Lincoln. And he says, how can we get blacks to vote Democrat? And he goes, you must show that the military, which is the largest institution in America for employment, is fair, which means allowing blacks to fly planes. And FDR said, who would lead it? And he said, my son, Ben Jr., goes down to Tuskegee, and they say, how will you be able to staff this with qualified blacks? They had just trained them for 4 years. They snapped their finger. 15,000 black men and women go down to Tuskegee. And at 29 years old, never being in charge of another person outside of college, he commands and creates and controls the Tuskegee Airmen. And to me, that was the part of the story. When you take his name out of the movie, you've done an injustice to the whole thing.
Yeah, that's not at all interesting. Why would anyone want to do
that? I don't know. Why would anybody care? I can think of 18 Netflix series that should come out of this. Just right. 18 alone.
I am curious, Doug, about the whole notion of erasure that you've touched on. And I come at it from this point of view. I've heard of your grandfather. I've heard of him. Like,
yeah.
Because when I was 8 years old, when we had Black History Month in Washington, D.C., we learned about General we learned about, you know, Benjamin O. Davis. We learned about, and so, you know, we learned about these historical figures. Mm-hmm. And me being eight, I thought, okay, well, everybody knows this now, right? Like, everybody knows that Charles Drew invented blood plasma, and everybody knows Jan Metzlinger invented the shoe. I forget what they call the shoe device that allows you to build 700 pairs of shoes in an hour, which used to take months to do. Everybody knows that. I remember the guy's name that invented the traffic light. Everybody knows this, right? And you just think as a kid, okay, everybody understands that black people were directly involved in history, in the history of this country. And it turns out they don't. They don't. And that is that's why what you're doing is so important. And I wanted to ask you, because my dad passed away 2 years ago, and one of the treasures I have with him, and I didn't do it enough, but I did it once or twice, is I took out my phone and I said, Dad, tell me about your life. Tell me something about your life. And he told the most amazing stories. And I feel terrible that I didn't tape enough of them, but it's like, at least I have some memory of him talking about his life. And you talk about that, like, these treasures are sitting on your sofa. talk to them about their lives. It's incredible if you'll talk to them.
They want to share, but the silent generation is humble, and a lot of people felt in silence their safety.
Yeah.
So they didn't share with their children. They didn't share with their nephews and grandkids. So they said, hey, you know, we went through it. We will bear what that was. So yeah. You, David, and Jamie, you all can live your dream.
Right.
Right.
And that was why no one said anything, but the erasure out there, and I think the important thing for me in the second half of the book, I walk through all the different steps that I did to encourage your own family to say, hey, if this story was invisible in my own family, I mean, come on. There's thousands of them, you know, I mean, a million maybe. I mean, we just don't know.
Yeah.
And I think to
your point, Doug, in so many walks of life, but Jamie, let me ask you, Jamie and I have known each other for way too long. But Jamie, you've covered the military for decades. And I can think about, you know, the period when you and I were really engaged, the small number of minorities at very high levels, very few number of Blacks at the highest levels in the military. But what was your reaction? What was your response when you're reading this and thinking about how it applies to what a Black in the military is dealing with today?
Well,
because the problem still exists. The challenges that Ben faced are just mind blowing. But
there are still invisible generals in the military. And, immediately flashed to the story of Lloyd Austin, the first Black Secretary of Defense, who was a 4-star general. And in an interview, I remember an interview he gave with David Barton of CBS, excellent reporter who was doing a piece for 60 Minutes. I remember Austin telling David that there wasn't a moment that he was in the military that he wasn't aware that he was Black. Yeah. And that there was an instance where he was the commander of the, I think it was the 82nd Airborne. He was a lieutenant colonel. And he, you know, he knew that the generals and the commanders didn't really listen to him because he was Black. And so he arranged for a white officer to give his briefings so that they would be listened to. Because if you are a Black officer in the military, even then, and you're the only Black person in the room, you really did have this feeling that you were invisible. And he told a story about when he got to be a 4-star general, and he would be traveling around with his staff, and if they weren't in uniform, if they were in business suits, people would be told, "Oh, the command, the general's come. General Austin's coming. He's coming with his staff." And he would arrive, and they would walk up. He was not the one they would walk up to, assuming that he was the general.
Of course,
I mean, and this is now,
right? This is now. Think about what Ben Jr. went through in 1936.
That was his conscious bias, and there's still conscious bias today, but there's also this unconscious bias, like just assuming, oh, the Black guy couldn't be the general, this white guy. But, you know, we've come a long way, but we haven't come nearly as far as I think some people would like to think we have come.
Right. And one of the challenging things is it's like an age old whatever. Like the military, you know, one of the reasons you really should appreciate, et cetera, respect the military, because they, you know, social experimentation, social progression, they help bring, you know, integration. Well, maybe sort not. Of. Sort of. Kind of.
Ish.
But Doug, ish. Oh, it's ish. It's hyphen ish. Yeah. You know how the dictionaries do those things, those words and expressions of the year? I think we should have hyphen ish. Okay, yeah. Doug, let's get you. Wait, no, I got to be really respectful. Let me get you out with this, Doug.
No, I'm fine. No, we're all just, this is like a potluck.
Okay, Jamie, well, David's
got David, is that a team's hand,
fine,
Jamie?
I'm
What's
fine.
Happening?
This is a great team's topic. Hand?
It's a great topic. No, I usually, in nonfiction, I hate subheads, Doug, because they're usually endless and long and, God, just torture. But in yours, Invisible Generals, Rediscovering Family Legacy, and a Quest to Honor America's First Black Generals. As I said before, you're in this book, which I love. And there's a personal mission in this book.
Yeah.
Did you accomplish the quest you personally were perceiving? You were pursuing, sorry, pursuing.
Yeah, the quest was to get the story into the world and have it be accepted. You know, when you're a first-time writer and they say 70,000 words, all you say is, uh-oh. You know, I mean, I'm just saying, you know, I can knock out a 700 to 1,000, maybe a 1,200 on a good day, 1,500 if you're lucky. Right. But when you start talking about these numbers,
that's great.
you know, that was tough for me. So I think just getting it into the world and having it, you know, be accepted. It's almost, I don't have children and yet, or maybe ever, but what I'm saying is it was like, to me, equivalent to birthing a piece of art, where the first thing was, let's not let the reviewers tank the baby before the thing can crawl.
Right.
So that was, you know, the first, you know, if you're really going through it. I think in the pie in the sky, you know, like if I could actually create my own reality, I would like the president to award Ben Jr. the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which I think he is deserving of. And I think they should put it around my dad's, you know, 90-year-old neck and, you know, actually experience that part. I think in the future, I would really like more people to understand the story like we do Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, and understand, like you were saying, David, all these inventions that people have. You know, they created the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, airport security, the United States Air Marshal Program, you know, the Flying Thunderbirds, the line that separates China and Taiwan. In Taiwan is called the Davis Line because they created it. They flew the plane over it. They measured it out. They passed it through the White House to the UN. These are people in America we don't know anything about. So wish the mission would be to continue to have people like yourselves be curious, be excited about history in a way where we can make this more contemporary and not make it some dusty old thing that happened back in the day, but say, you know, we are the result. You know, like I say, it's generational collateral. We are the receipts of their journey. So we it's our responsibility. Maybe our responsibility is to tell the story of their story. Yes. You know, like you were saying, Dave, maybe your father lived and that was his story.
Yeah.
But now that we have media and it's a different world, our story is actually telling their story in a way.
Yeah. Well, we have access.
I was just going to say a sort of a coda to all this, that the other thing that really struck me was, I remember the stories written about Lloyd Austin when he was nominated by Joe Biden to be the defense secretary that I think really underestimated him. And one of the things that you would hear often was that he wasn't a showy general. Some people said he wasn't a visionary, but he had a reputation of just being very quiet, not speaking much to the media, not talking much about it. And so it really struck me when you're having in the book the conversation with your father, and he tells you that, you know, that you just don't talk about it. You just do your job. You don't make waves and don't complain about it. You just put your head down and do it. And I think there's so many cases where somebody doing that is misinterpreted as somehow they're not confident or they're not competent, which is exactly the opposite of what the facts are.
Right.
Well, you know, Jimmy, the thing about that is when you deal with race, stereotypes sometimes trump reality, or they become reality. And at the time, being vocal as a person of color was uppity, was disrespectful.
Well, get you killed is what would happen.
Exactly, David. It's
there's that too.
Yeah. And I share in the book, never drive at night.
Yeah.
You know, they always tell them, don't leave. All the attention is only going to hurt. So act as if you're invisible and you could stay in the job. And maybe that was something that was passed down to General Austin. You know, maybe his father before him told him, maybe other commanders in his position, even not at the level of rank, told him, if you want to be successful as you. And this was something Ben Jr. would say when people would say, how are you in the military when they treat you like this? And all they beat you mentally and all these things, and you come back every day wanting to do more. And he would say, because my reality is that I have to do this so the next generation could be free. The person next to me, someone did it before them so he could be free, but I can't look at that guy.
Yeah. Right.
That's his situation. Mine is this. And in practice, that's much harder to do than saying it, but he was able to do it mentally. And I think those are the same characteristics in some respects that General Austin has, because there is a unspoken challenge. I don't talk too frequently, but I have talked several times with a General Q Brown, who's the new Joint Chiefs of Staff. He is an Air Force pilot. He has been so incredible to our family, shows up, does the videos, helps, you know, support all the things. And he has a picture of Ben Davis in his office, and he always talks about reminding himself what they went through and what they did. And he's almost in some ways a student of that. So I think maybe that silence is transferred just through the historical record of others in those positions.
Wow. Okay. Here's something small that we can do, but I would really like to do it, Doug. And I don't think we've never done it on this show. We've talked so much about what we're thinking about Ben Davis Jr. and the military and what he endured and these kinds of things. Incredible. The decades after were just phenomenal. As you said, 55 mile an hour speed limit, air marshals, Taiwan, et cetera. And I want to find time to focus on that because I think it's really, really important. You know, we don't say this often on this show because there's not too much important associated with our show. But I think this is an important book. And I think, a step to that ceremony you described is, all kidding aside, you know, the Netflix series, you know, bringing this to life in ways above and beyond just the book. And just the book is fantastic. So thank you so, so, so much for doing it. David and Jamie, I'm not going to subject them to 60 seconds more. It's too embarrassing. It's too awful.
I think that's a good idea.
But we'll ask you one question. One question, Doug, because it's usually revealing and illuminating. What was your favorite childhood book?
Everything I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, but I think that was a poem. But
best ever.
You
know, best
you remember
ever.
That one? Do you guys know that
made
one?
Made it into a book. So.
That was totally. That was, and actually the other one was Of Mice and Men. I really enjoyed that.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, only because it was the perception, not knowing your own power. You know, it was a lot of things when you're growing up that you could relate to, how people perceive you, what people say about you, not knowing how to reply, different kind of character traits that people are given at a different age based on where they grow up.
Yeah. That's good. That's really good. And I hope you're increasingly aware of and appreciative of the power you have, because your ability to bring these really, really important things to life is fabulous. So tiny bit of housekeeping and then we'll get out. Housekeeping. Mm-hmm. We're back next week, everybody, with Rebecca Renner. It's just such a holiday book, people. Next week, we are going to be doing Gator Country by Rebecca Renner. Deception, Danger, and Alligators in the Everglades.
There you go.
How much better could you say? But in the meantime, Lauren, thank you for taking care of us this evening, my friend. Jamie, thank you very much. David?
Yes, thank you.
Good to see you, my friend, as ever. Doug Melville, the book is fantastic. I hope everybody goes out and gets this for the holidays, for beyond. Hopefully it's your favorite independent bookstore. It's Invisible Generals. It's fabulous. And thanks, everybody. And we'll see you next week.
Inspiring.
It's inspiring.
It is.